Okay, so today, this is my talk, Buddhist Teachings About Environmental Responsibility, part one. As I sat down to plan this, I initially thought, well, I'll give you just an overview of all the Buddhist teachings that you could say argue for environmental responsibility. But then I only got through one. And I thought, all right, well, this is just part one, which is great. So when I chose the term environmental responsibility, I mean, you know, honestly, this kind of, it's kind of a cold term. It's kind of accurate. It's appropriate, but it's rather cold and mechanistic. So our dedication of merit at the end of our full morning chanting service mentions this. And if you've never come, this is what we do. You know, there's a half an hour chanting service, and then we do Zazen, and then we have a break, and then we do this talk. So on Sundays, we do this full chanting service. And at the end, we have this dedication of merit, which I have to confess has gotten very, very long at this point, but it's very sweet. You know, it's like a list of all of the suffering beings and beings who have passed who we want to call to mind. And then we have a wish at the end, you know, may we all attain liberation and what have you. So included in that used to be this: may great compassion inspire all to wise stewardship of our planet, its ecosystems, and wondrous creatures. So this was a line that I added to, you know, if you went to Dharma Rain, for instance, you would recognize most of the dedication of merit, but that, you know, I inserted that line. But then, I don't know, after some reflection, I don't know, a year or two of reflection, I changed it to this: may great compassion cause all to awaken to our interdependence with our planet, its ecosystems, and wondrous creatures. So I changed it from wise stewardship to awakening to our interdependence. Because as we know, I mean, I guess stewardship isn't the worst thing, you know. If we all decided to be good stewards, that would be good, but that still views the environment or whatever as something separate, as something we're taking care of, as if that's an option, right? This is like, more and more we're recognizing that this climate and ecological crisis is really a crisis for human beings. You know, to some extent, it's like, well, there's been many extinctions on the planet. Life has gone through many changes. You know, I mean, there will be life again if we ruin it all. What's really at stake, I mean, there's many things at stake, but you know, human beings, human life, human civilization is at stake. So this is, in some ways, this is like the self-interest and caring for the planet are intertwined. So this idea of interdependence is something I think Buddhism can contribute to this current struggle of humankind to live in harmony with nature instead of simply exploiting it for profit until it's destroyed. And it can contribute many other things, but I think that's one of the most important. So, you know, I say environmental responsibility to be clear, but we could also think of what we're talking about is a sense of non-separation from all life, of non-separation from all manifestation of being, including mountains and rivers and oceans, clouds and rocks, recognition of all things as Buddha nature, spiritual fulfillment through bodhisattva practice to all beings, seeing oneself as in the same boat as all beings. So what are the Buddhist teachings which point us toward all of this? Which I think, as Buddhists, that we should be passionate about environmental responsibility. and not just as a moral obligation, but as something central to our practice. Now, many religions, including Buddhism, did not evolve to be nature-based. You know, there are many more indigenous kinds of spirituality, which just are really rooted in place and rooted in, you know, direct connection to nature. So it's much more explicit. So it's not as explicit in Buddhism. And yet I think there's plenty here that we can look into, and it's not even about, you know, reinterpreting, it's almost expanding or going more deeply into these teachings and what the implications are. So, and I want to hopefully help us all see this connection to nature, this environmental responsibility, as really central to our practice, as an essential aspect, in the sense that practice without it would be incomplete, too limited, too self-centered, or lacking in imagination. So the first teaching I'm going to start out with, and then I've kind of left plenty of time for us to reflect on it and discuss and see what else comes up, rather than rushing on to the next teaching. So I think it all begins with the Buddha's story. So just very briefly, most of you are probably familiar with the Buddha's story, but Prince Siddhartha, 2,500 years ago, was a prince, but you know, he was rich, he was well off, he was privileged and insulated from most suffering, but nonetheless, deep spiritual questions arose in him. He left his comfortable life and he went off as an ascetic and he did all these practices looking for spiritual answers. And eventually he decided to practice the middle way, and he was seeking a place to sit, to settle into deep meditation. And all right, this, now he's going to awaken. So there's a story about this, his enlightenment scenario from the Jataka tales. So the Jataka are verses or past life tales. And there are verses in the Pali canon, the official canon of the Theravada school. But then there was also commentary on those verses. And they're not technically part of the canon, but they're also an ancient text and maintained and revered. And then there's an introduction to the Jataka, which was pieced together from pieces that the Buddha said. So he would say, he would be giving a teaching and he would say, that reminds me of a time. And like he would mention these aspects of his life, which then were pieced together into this story of kind of autobiographical story, which has many supernatural aspects to it. So he has decided, you know, but Siddhartha's chosen a seat for enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And he says, let my skin and sinews and bones become dry and welcome. And let all the flesh and blood in my body dry up. But never from this seat shall I stir until I have attained the supreme and absolute wisdom. So after he does this, he suffers interference and temptation from Mara, the deity of the realm of desire. Because Mara wants us all to stay with the Buddhists see as the realm of desire, you know, driven by desire for comfort and aversion to discomfort. And if the Buddha finds a way out, then Mara's in trouble, right? Then his, you know, he won't have as many people in his realm. So he decides to wage battle on Siddhartha and make sure that he can't awaken. So he has an unimaginably large army of demons and supernatural beings. He has an elephant named Girded with Mountains, is 150 leagues high. And Mara, you know, is unfazed by the army. So Mara sends like a torrential rainstorm and gale force winds, a shower of rocks, dense darkness. And, you know, Siddhartha is unmoved. He's practiced for many years. His meditation is very deep and his determination is deep. So this is a section from this intro to the Jataka. Thus was Mara unable by these nine, the wind and the rain and the rocks and the weapons and the charcoal and the ashes and the sand and the mud and the darkness, to drive away the future Buddha. So he called on his host and said, "Why stand you still? Seize or slay or drive away this prince." And he himself mounted the mountain girded mountain elephant, and seated on his back, he approached the future Buddha and cried out, "Get up, Siddhartha, from that seat. It does not belong to you. It is meant for me." The great being listened to his words and said, "Mara, it is not by you that the 10 cardinal virtues have been perfected, nor the lesser virtues, nor the higher virtues. It is not you who have sacrificed yourself in the 5 great acts of self-renunciation, who have diligently sought after knowledge and the salvation of the world and the attainment of wisdom. This seat does not belong to you. It is to me that it belongs." Then the enraged Mara, unable to endure the vehemence of his anger, cast at the great being that scepter javelin of his, the barb of which was in the shape as a wheel. But it became a garland of flowers and remained as a canopy over the Buddha, whose mind was bent upon good. Now at other times, when that wicked one throws his scepter javelin, it cleaves asunder a pillar of solid rock, as if it were the tender shoot of a bamboo. When, however, it thus turned into a garland canopy, all the host of Mara shouted, "Now he shall rise from his seat and flee," and they hurled at him huge masses of rock. But these too fell on the ground as bouquets at the feet of him whose mind was bent upon good. And the angels stood at the edge of the rocks that encircle the world, and stretching forwards in amazement, they looked on, saying, "Lost, lost is Siddhartha the prince, the glorious and beautiful. What can he do to save himself?" Then the great being exclaimed, "I have reached the throne on which sit the Buddhas to be when they are perfect in all goodness, and on that day when they shall reach enlightenment." And he said to Mara, standing there before him, "Mara, who is witness that thou hast given alms, that thou hast passed acts of generosity?" And Mara stretched forth his hand to the hosts of his followers and said, "So many are my witnesses." And that moment there arose a shout as the sound of an earthquake from the hosts of the evil one, saying, "I am his witness, I am his witness." Then the tempter addressed the great being and said, "Siddhartha, who is witness that thou hast given alms?" And the great being answered, "Thou hast living witnesses that thou hast given alms, and I have in this place no living witnesses at all. But not counting the alms I have given in other births, let this great and solid earth, unconscious though it be witness of the 7-fold great alms I gave when I was born as Vesantara." And withdrawing his right hand from beneath his robe, he stretched it forth toward the earth and said, "Are you or are you not witness of the 700-fold great gift I gave in my birth as Vesantara?" And the great earth uttered a voice saying, "I am witness to thee of that." Overwhelming as it were the hosts of the evil one as with the shout of hundreds of thousands of foes. Then the mighty elephant girded with mountains, as he realized what the generosity of Vesantara had been, fell down on his knees before the great being. And the army of Mara fled this way and that, so that not even two were left together Throwing off their clothes and their turbans, they fled, each one straight on before him. I was getting an image of them going so fast that they leave their clothes behind, like in a cartoon. So I wanted to share an image. So this is a, can those online see it? Okay, and you guys can see it too. So from way, way back, there's different kinds of Buddhist iconography. Once this, it actually took a few hundred years after the Buddha's death before they started making Buddha statues, but there's different iconography. So depending on how the Buddha's hands are, there's, it means different things, but this is Earth Witness Mudra. This is Earth Witness Buddha. So you know that when you see this, this is Shakyamuni Buddha. And then one other one. This is a Tibetan Tonka. Actually, I think that one might be different because his hand's facing out. Oh, well, you get the idea. So from way, way back, this has been a deep and powerful symbol. So reflecting on the symbolism here, before the Buddha could awaken, before he could attain liberation, he had to face all kinds of challenges. I mean, this makes sense. We are very familiar with that. We have to face all kinds of challenges if we want to awaken, if we want to practice, if we want to deepen our wisdom. And that's, I always feel like, you know, kind of symbolized by, you know, all these things that, that Mara was throwing at the Buddha. But ultimately, maybe the biggest obstacle we face is the question, you know, who are we? What have we done? How have we lived? Have we been of benefit to others? Or primarily been on the lookout for our own well-being? Have we been generous? Have we lived with gratitude? Have we been silent while we witnessed harm being perpetrated on others? Are we complicit in systems that prioritize people, profits over people and Earth's ecosystems and wondrous creatures? An ultimate reckoning. Our relationship to other beings, to life, is not a side issue. You know, this is the very last moment. And he had overcome all other kinds of obstacles. And at the very last moment, Shakyamuni Buddha had to, and you know, we externalize it to Mara, but essentially, you know, this is our own process and our own doubts and our own challenges we have to overcome. Who are we and what kind of life have we lived? So every generation, every country has added wisdom to Buddhism. That's one of the things I really appreciate about it, is we never look at it as just a fixed and dogmatic thing. This is what the Buddha said, and never shall we add to that, right? It's understood that this is a living tradition that hopefully, in each generation, there are fairly enlightened teachers who can teach us, and then we can teach others, and we pass it on. And early on, Mahayana Buddhism recognized the value of skillful means, that it's not just about some core message, it's about, does the person really get it? Like, what? How do you actually communicate what you need to communicate to somebody? And it depends. It depends on who they are. It depends on their situation. It depends on our culture. It depends on many things. Can we actually take in the message? So currently, one of the things that I think, that I hope, that we are adding to Buddhist teaching, and it may be there to some extent, but certainly we are hopefully bringing this out, is a transition from interpreting Buddhist teaching and practice only or primarily using the frame of reference of the individual. So, you know, from the beginning, it's really like, really is true. It's like this world is full of suffering, but you can work on yourself, your own mind and body and behavior, and you can attain liberation from suffering. You can live at ease in this world. Now, as you do that, you naturally become a kind and generous person who is going to help others do this as well. So it's not just, you know, completely selfish thing, right? You become unselfish as you are liberated. But it's still very much of an individually focused thing. But hopefully the way that we hold Buddhism is reflecting changes in our larger culture as well, where we are really, we're recognizing we have collective karma as well, right? This is all being reflected in the new ways that we are looking at history, and we're looking at the structure of society, and we realize it's not only about my views as an individual. It's not, you know, there's racism that an individual might hold, like racist views and biases and what have you. But it's more than that, right? Even if we don't hold explicitly racist views, we are part of a larger system. We have a collective karma, which affects us and which we need to take responsibility for. How do we take that responsibility, you know, as individuals? But can we essentially apply the same Buddhist principles to groups of people? And I think and hope we can. That's a lot of the discussion. Certainly, I'm sure, I think probably Buddhists who are exploring anti-racism, and certainly Buddhists like David Lloyd, who are exploring eco-dharma, are trying to like get us to think beyond just our own individual minds and bodies and behavior, and to think more broadly about how do these principles apply in a collective way. So reframing the Buddha's awakening as a collective experience. So imagining, all right, so humanity is seeking peace and happiness and liberation and faces many challenges. What if we, as this collective humanity trying to awaken, what if we were to call the earth as witness to humanity's collective generosity right now? What if we were to say, oh, we're okay. We've been doing good. Yes, earth, can you bear witness to that? I don't know. I think the earth really kind of bears witness to a little bit of the opposite at this point. Do we see evidence of humanity's lack of wisdom and generosity in the earth, our planet, our ecosystems, and wondrous creatures? So given this teaching, what should we do? So this is also going to apply to any of the future teachings that I share about teachings that may point us toward environmental responsibility. This is not such a straightforward thing. At least some of us with dualistic minds want a clear answer that we can either accept or reject. Therefore, as a Buddhist, you should avoid plane travel, and you should be vegetarian, and you should be politically active for a quick transition off of fossil fuels, and you should, you know, come up with, like, this is how you should live if you want to be a good Buddhist. And then you could say, well, I don't want to do that, or you could say, yeah, we should do that. But action and response, actually doing something and responding and taking responsibility, is entirely necessary. But when it comes to our own lives, each of us navigates these choices as an individual or as the member of a family. But we can agree on the underlying value. So rather than getting stopped, getting caught up in, you know, differences and arguments and getting stuck on the how, connecting, sharing, nodding toward what is the deeper ideal, which I think more and more of us can agree on. What is the underlying value which can serve as a direction, a guide, a reference point, an ideal? Reaching down and touching the great earth and having her respond, yes, you guys are doing all right. We know the great earth doesn't demand perfection. We know some killing, some consumption is necessary in order to live. But Indigenous cultures the world over have lived in a sustainable way with their environments for millennia. So a different way is possible. So I am going to leave it there. And we can have some discussion, questions, comments. I kind of deliberately left this a little open-ended. Here's a teaching, and my sense of it is that even though it can be overlooked quite easily, right, it's just kind of an incidental part of this kind of far out mythological story of the Buddha. You know, I think there's something really, really significant there. If anybody is in the cloud who's not familiar with this, you can, down under reactions, you can choose raise hand, and then I will see who would like to chime in. John.
Thank you, Demia. I'm curious, why did the Buddha call upon the earth to bear witness? Is there any thought in the story as to why that happened?
I mean, good question. I think it's very significant. I read something I saw online today pointed out that he didn't call on the heavens. He didn't call on the deities in heaven to bear witness. And according to Buddhist mythology, there's all kinds of beings and deities and stuff out there. And he didn't call on them. I mean, I think that's a good question to explore. I mean, what does that mean? That his ultimate friend, his ultimate witness was the earth itself. I don't know. I'm would happy to have other people chime in about your senses of this, but I'll say mine and then you come and do yours. I mean, just for me, it's kind of like the rest of my practice when I sit zazen or I'm living my life and I try to just come back to this, you know, it's this, it's right here. It's this embodied existence. We're always, our feet are always on the earth. Well, unless we're in a plane, but you know, whatever. we're still pulled by gravity, right? So yeah, I feel like it's a symbol of just this is where the reality is. But I don't think we have to limit it there either, right? I think imaginatively, which is you know, some of the other things that I'm going to cover in this little series, you know, when the Buddha talks about all being is Buddha nature. So it's not just a matter of like little human beings over here and we're doing our spiritual thing. It's like we are the earth, we are the rocks, we are the other people. I don't know, John, what do you think?
I don't have an opinion, but I'm going to think on it.
Katie had a... Go ahead.
Yeah, I just felt like it was like the ultimate authority. I mean, he's appealing to the ultimate authority. And I think maybe they wanted a little surprise in there, you know, because it's like, oh, yeah, I could see them all thinking as they hearing that story. Oh, yeah, the earth. Yeah. Wow. If the earth was behind you, you'd have everything. Mm-hmm. And so I approve of that story. Thank you. That's all.
Denny.
I think that sometimes we forget just how in our day-to-day lives, how separated we are from the earth compared to indigenous cultures, or cultures that are were thousands of years old. I've been thinking a lot about this lately. I mean, we live in buildings that are by and large geometrically formed by a lot of tools that measure right angles. And our cities are laid out that way too. Our cities and the routes we take between our homes and our work are basically grids. And we step from our doors into our cars and ride those grids and go from building to building. That's a rectangle or a square or stacked rectangles. There's typically, unless you're a gardener and you love to have lots of plants around, there's nothing green and living for the most part in your house. When you eat it, most people eat what they want and throw the rest of the plants in the trash that goes into a landfill and sits there forever in plastic instead of composting somewhere outdoors so it can be returned back to the earth. We don't spend much quiet time. A lot of people like to camp, but then they've got all kinds of stuff that they have to take with them to make their camping experience comfortable and safe. And so I don't even think that we can imagine these days what it would be like to live really close to the earth and nature and all of its sentient beings. And to have to adjust to that and to be at the mercy of it at times. We are just so protected. And one more short thing. I had the privilege of working with 3 years with one of the most well-known curators of American Indian art. We went through the whole collection and had to interpret it for the general public. And that was one of the most amazing experiences I had in my life, because every single object in that collection was tied somehow to the earth. And there was no separation, as you said earlier, Domio, from this story. Or maybe it was just in your introduction to the story. One quick example, the women in the Lakota nation were keepers of the medicines, and they would go out into the woods and pick plants. They had special songs that they would sing to each particular plant in gratitude for their sacrifice. And that's just one example of many, many things. And So I can really understand why the Buddha would call on the earth. And there's also the Gaia concept too, so.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is quite ridiculous that the level at which human beings think like nature is just a pretty thing to go recreate in, you know, like that dependence, right? We've completely, the kind of lifestyles you're talking about, you know, you're constantly reinforcing and reminding yourselves of that dependence on nature. And we can imagine ourselves, you know, in a sci-fi way, right? A dystopia kind of future, but you know, we'll all just be in buildings, and there won't be any nature anymore, and there won't be any animals. And you know, I mean, if you've read any sci-fi, you've probably read a scenario like this, which is like, that's not actually possible. That's not actually like the imagination that like, well, nature's not there anymore, and that's too bad because it was really pretty. Like, it's like, what, you know, and I feel like the climate crisis is one of the things that's really pointing us toward, that's not possible. Like, we are completely dependent on, we're not separate from nature. We've just been living as if we are. Brian.
Thank you. I was just reading this morning, I mean, I was listening to you about eco-culture and Buddhism, and I was reading something from Dogen, you know, I'll just quote it just here. I just read it this morning, that's why it stuck in my mind. When we walk in the midst without knowing it, our clothing becomes moist. If we keep company with good people, we will unwittingly become good people. Where I take this is it's as a Sangha, if we practice eco-culturalism and that stuff too, our group becomes sensitive to it, and so on, so on, so on. I live on an island. 20 years ago, I came to the island. I didn't care about garbage or water. It didn't even think about it. You know, I bought a house, had a well, but I didn't even pay attention. I'm surrounded by water all over me, every place. But that water is not drinkable. It's salt water. And meanwhile, now I become a water activist, you know, about water tables and all this stuff. And we're at level 4 water restrictions here on the island because of drought. We've been going through drought for 5 years now. It's getting worse every year. And now we become more conscious. So I become, conscious about water. And when I came here, it was the first time we started to recycle. When I lived overseas, you threw your garbage out, somebody came, went through your garbage and recycled it for you and made a living that doing that. Here, we pay to have our garbage removed. We have 3 boxes, a blue box for recyclables, a black for garbage, and a green for compost. And they come once a week and they take them away. Now, I have noticed over the years, slowly, less and less and less and less being used. Here, when I moved, I end up getting a large, and you also pay for the size of box that's just removed. So I got a bigger blue because I want to recycle more, smaller black, and a pretty good size compost. So I have 3, 2, and 1 sort of like. Now I'm finding that I'm now even besides cycling and going through everything and being aware, when I buy stuff, I'm more aware. When I put stuff in the garbage, I'm finding, well, actually, I don't have to collect it every week. We can wait 2 weeks because I don't have as much garbage. I don't have as much recyclable. Even my recyclables are coming down because I'm more conscious with it. But it's the community is like that. Everybody's like that. As you dive down the street, you see all the boxes and you see they're getting smaller, smaller, and smaller. Mm-hmm. People are becoming more aware of it. And I think as a group, whether it's Buddhism or Sangha or something, if we practice that, it becomes natural. It's a way of life. And it's not like I'm being hard done by to do it. It becomes second nature. And I feel very comfortable doing it now.
Thank you. Yeah, oh, go ahead.
So I just wanted to make a comment about really listening to the young generation. My son, he's 15 now, but I will say even at probably 8, 9 years old, the number one thing keeping him up at night was the environmental crisis. Mm-hmm. And so many kids are like this. And there's so much frustration. I think you're looking at the older generations, we're the ones that vote, put the policies into place, and not feeling heard. And as we see this, you know, like Greta Thunberg and so forth, and that movement, and going around to these politicians and asking for help and being ridiculed and being ignored. And there's a lot of wisdom, I think, in these young people who are incarnating right now, and they have a lot to teach us. And I notice with my son and his friends, I mean, they're very conscientious about things that a lot of us maybe didn't, especially at that age, think about. You know, in terms of transportation and you know, plastics, and they look at this and they have a lot of wisdom. They know this place won't be here if we don't take care of it. So I think it's really important to really listen to their voices. Yep.
I mean, that is just a perfect segue into my talking about Ruth Ann, did you have something?
I want to hear, you said you were going to elaborate a bit more on the 15th, and all of the comments have been wonderful. I was thinking, since Buddhism reminds us of the symbolism of mountains, rivers, clouds, we're asked to consider the impermanence of life, which means those magnificent features of Earth. So if they're going to be impermanent, where are we on that scale? You know, little creatures. So thank you for this.
Thank you. This Friday, so there's something happening in Portland, but I think there's going to be echoes of it in many places across, I don't know, probably across the world, probably across the US. There's, you know, it's pretty typical for climate action to be kind of concentrated on a particular weekend, so people can all kind of go out and generate energy. And there's going to be a very big demonstration, march, whatever, in New York on Sunday the 17th, but in kind of conjunction on Friday the 15th, there's going to be a lot of youth on climate strike. So this has been something going on for a while that Greta Thunberg started, you know, Fridays for Future. And so, you know, high school students will skip out on Friday classes periodically to speak out on climate. And this in particular, in Portland, they're going to have the Portland Youth Climate Strike, and they're assembling starting at 11 downtown Portland in front of City Hall. And I've been to one of these Portland Youth Climate Strike marches before, and it's very, very boisterous and, you know, serious, but kind of celebratory as well, as you would expect with like thousands of high school students taking the day off. They have, you know, clever signs and they have, you know, speeches and what have you. And then they march a couple miles to another location, and there's more stuff going on there. You know, in support of that, because this is a youth-led thing, it's not like we as adults go in and we're just like, oh, can we help you with that? They're like, no, thanks. You know, they got it. But near where the youth are gathering, a group of us are going to have an interfaith service. So there's going to be a Zen priest from Zen Community of Oregon offering something. I think it's going to be two Christian pastors and a lay leader from a local Jewish community. And we're going to put together a little service. There's going to be some singing and some chanting and whatever. And then after that, some folks are going to go off, and this one group, Eco Faith Recovery, has, they've done this before, and they're going to do it again, where they go stand on a street corner and let the youth march go by, and they have a chant, they have chants that they do that kind of incorporate the signs that the youth are holding. So they kind of chant in support. And then some of us, I mean, I don't know, maybe we'll all do that, but some of us are planning to just kind of, you know, find a place and watch the thing go by and just stand like this or something with a, you know, a supportive sign. Yeah, we need to listen to the youth. So it's not going to be that long. You can join the march afterwards, what have you. But I will just briefly explain my, my changing relationship to all of this. There's been a quite a long time where I kind of, well, for lack of a better word, just kind of poo-pooed this kind of action. All right, whatever. We're just going to go do our little interfaith service. What difference does that make? Well, I mean, I guess I kind of got burned out on trying to make a difference. It's very hard to make a difference. It's very, very hard to know what to do to find something that you really know is going to be effective. So we got to do something. Doing nothing doesn't feel right. And there's also, I'm thinking of these kinds of actions as being what I call bearing witness actions, where we're going to open our hearts and minds to what is going on just for that. You might say it's for our own sake, and yet it's also for other beings' sake. So anyway, that is what we are doing on Friday, and I have a few minutes left. So I figured I would do something really wacky and share with you a song that I am planning to bring to that action. And we can kind of like practice singing it together. And you don't have to, those of you on Zoom have to stay muted anyway, but go ahead and belt it out at home. It's called Turning of the World. It's a very, very beautiful song. I didn't make that many copies, but perhaps those of you here can kind of share, and then I will pull it up and share it with the Zoom crowd. Okay, so it's Turning, it's called Turning of the World. And
oh, she's got them on.
So you probably can't see the entire thing if you're on Zoom, but I'll scroll as I go. Essentially, it's the same verse, but at first you say turning, then you say healing, then you say dreaming, then you say loving. All right, so I am not a professional musician or singer, but I brought my little guitar because the it sounds terrible, but so just join in when you feel. Maybe I'll actually not put this around. It'll be easier to be like this. All right. Let us sing this song for the turning of the world, with everyone as one, With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will fill the echo of our journey. With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along. With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo of our journey. Let us sing this song for the healing of the world, that we may heal as one. With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will fill the echo of our healing. With every song, we will move this world along. With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will fill the echo of our healing. Let us sing this song, dreaming of the world, that we may dream as one. With every voice, with every song, we world along, and our lives to feel the echo of our dreaming. With every song, we will make this world along. With every voice, with every song, we will make this world along, and our lives to feel the echo of our dreaming. Let us sing this song for the loving of the world, that we may love as one. With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will fill the echo of our loving. With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will fill the echo of our loving, and our lives will fill the echo of our loving, and our lives will fill the echo of our healing. Thank you, everyone. I'm an alto too, like. But I learned this. I figured out the melody, and now I'm gonna learn it. So, all right. Well, we offer the merit of this song of meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.